You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Happy inaugural day. Today was the second inaugural speech by President Obama. He being one, really only the second president since FDR, a Democratic president, to give a second inaugural address. Who else had two terms? Clinton, right. So Clinton gave a second inaugural address. FDR gave a second inaugural address. Johnson didn't. He served a term and a half. Carter served one term. Kennedy served less than a term. So that's it. In any case, the second inaugural address of President Obama, the main theme of this thing was we. And I thought it was absolutely brilliant in that regard. It was really all about we. He kept using that word over, and in fact, I would say, if anything, you know, there's a whole lot of different explanations about what an inaugural address is supposed to do in theories, and oh, it's supposed to set the tone, and or maybe it lays out a legislative agenda, although more often than not, that's the State of the Union address, which is coming up in a few more weeks. But mostly, it defines the frame. And what he did with this, by starting out by quoting Thomas Jefferson in the Declaration of Independence, the we hold these truths to be self-evident phrase, and then going through this list of together we determined that a modern economy, et cetera, together we discovered that a free market, et cetera, together we resolved that a great nation, et cetera. I'm going to play some of these clips for you in a minute, but preserving our individual freedoms, he says, ultimately requires collective action. And then he actually gives examples. No single person can train all the math and science teachers we'll need to equip our children for the future or build the roads and networks and research labs. Now more than ever, we need to do these things together. The entire frame of this entire speech was we are we. And in fact, I mean, you know, the big meme, the giant frame of libertarianism is that there literally is no we. Ayn Rand, Paul Ryan, all these crazed right-wing philosophers, Milton Friedman, economists, suggest that there is no society. There is only a group of individuals together. And they horribly misquote Adam Smith, you know, where he talked about by preferring the product of domestic manufacturer to foreign, he is guided by an invisible hand, blah, 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 blah. You know, Adam Smith is actually talking about the stupidity of free trade laws. I mean, but no, they somehow think that what that means is that if everybody acts selfishly, then everybody, you know, an entire nation of selfish individuals acting in their own selfish best interest will somehow produce some magical good for everybody. And it doesn't work that way. It's never worked that way. It isn't what Adam Smith said. In fact, Adam Smith, another, you know, in 1776, he published Wealth of Nations. He wrote another book called A Theory of Moral Sentiments, which basically rebutted the entire notion that if we all act selfishly, everything will be good. So President Obama, through this speech, kept saying over and over and over again, we. This frame, we, and he just stuck it to the Paul Ryan and Ayn Rand and libertarian and selfish Republican bunch of the world, whose main, this is clip eight, Shano, whose main meme is there are takers and there are makers. Paul Ryan's been doing, this has been Paul Ryan's stump speech since he first ran for Congress, that about a third of America are takers. They just take from the government. Right. You know, so whether it's Social Security or food stamps or welfare or whatever, Paul Ryan sees them as leeches, as takers. And then the other two thirds of us are makers. But the real makers, you know, in other words, we work for a living. But the real makers in Paul Ryan's world are the job creators. They are the ultimate makers. They are the billionaires. So there's takers and makers. President Obama had a few words for Congressman Ryan. Here it is.
The commitments we make to each other through Medicare and Medicaid and Social Security. These things do not sap our initiative. They strengthen us. They do not make us a nation of takers. They free us to take the risks that make this country great.
There you go. And I mean, just, and in fact, he said, what preceded that? He said, we do not believe that in this country freedom is reserved. I think this is one of the most brilliant parts of the speech. We do not believe in this country freedom is reserved for the lucky or happiness for the few. Notice he's starting with we. I mean, we recognize that no matter how responsibly we live our lives, any one of us, at any time may face a job loss or a sudden illness or a home swept away in a terrible storm. The commitments we make to each other through Medicare and Medicaid and Social Security, these things do not sap our initiative. They strengthen us. They do not make us a nation of takers. They free us to take the risks that make this country great. And then the following paragraphs, the next paragraph begins, we, the people, still believe that our obligations as Americans are not just to ourselves, but to all posterity. And the next paragraph, we, the people, still believe that enduring security and lasting peace do not require perpetual war. And then the next one, we will defend our people and uphold our values through strength of arms and rule of law. And then the next paragraph, and I mean, there's all kinds of sentences in between, but the next paragraph, we, the people, declare today that the most evident truths that all of us are created equal is the star that guides us still. And then he says, our journey is not complete until our wives, and he talks specifically, he starts calling out rights that are not yet fulfilled. I mean, he starts out with the Declaration of Independence saying all men are created equal. You know, this great and noble ideal. And he talks about how we haven't always we haven't always lived that out. But we've gotten better and better and better over the years. And so now he gets down to a little bit of nitty gritty here. He says, our journey is not complete until our wives, our mothers and daughters can earn a living equal to their efforts. That would be that equal pay for equal work law that the Republicans filibustered in the Senate. He said, our journey is not complete until our gay brothers and sisters are treated like anyone else under the law. For if we are truly created equal, then surely the love we commit to one another must be equal as well. You know, that let's do away with that Defense of Marriage Act that the Republicans, that John Boehner actually used taxpayer dollars to hire a private law firm to defend in court. And let's have, you know, the right to marriage equality as a right nationwide, straight or gay. He said, our journey is not complete until no citizen is forced to wait for hours to exercise the right to vote. Take that, John Kasich, Tom Corbett, Rick Snyder, Rick Scott. He said, our journey is not complete until we find a better way to welcome the striving, hopeful immigrants who see America as a land of opportunity. Take that, Sheriff Joe, and all your crazed buddies, until bright young students and engineers are enlisted in our workforce rather than expelled from our country. And then he says, for now, decisions are upon us, and we cannot afford to. Over and over and over again, he's using us and we. That is the big frame. He said, we can't substitute spectacle for politics or treat name-calling as reasoned debate. And in the very last paragraph, he says, with common effort and common purpose, let us answer the call of history. Yeah. A brilliant job of establishing the we, the people, the first three words of the Constitution, the we, the people, right?
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
15 minutes past the hour. Back with a couple of clips from this. And then I'm curious, what are your hopes and fears for the next 4 years? And are the Republicans meeting in the caucus room tonight? Occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. I didn't catch that picture, Jim. Was that one of your pictures from the... Oh, there it is. That's a picture that Jim Jovinsky took of President Obama as he was... You can tell Jim was like right standing right. Well, I'm assuming there was a little bit of a zoom on that lens. A little bit of a gap, yeah. But Jim was right there. That was a hoot. I was right there 4 years ago, and this year chose not to freeze to death. But I and TV gives you a pretty good view of it. Now, the other thing that we know about is that 4 years ago tonight, well, actually, it was 4 years ago last night. It was the 20th, but it was 4 years ago inaugural night. So functionally 4 years ago tonight. You could argue leap years or something, whatever. But 4 years ago, on the night of President Obama's inauguration, there was this small group of Republicans who got together in the caucus room restaurant and basically plotted treason. At least political treason. I mean, at the very least, you could call it political treason. And this, this is my keeper stack. This huge stack of papers here. And this group of Republicans basically came up with the idea that they were going to just destroy the Obama presidency. I mean, this is the, you know, when Mr. McTurtle said that, you know, his number one job was to make sure that the president was a one-term president, that, I mean, that's what they were doing. That's what these guys were doing, is they were conspiring to destroy the presidency. And how do you do it? Well, you do it by blocking every single piece of legislation that comes down the road. And, I mean, they were all about this. Here we go. The guest list was, this was, Robert Draper wrote about this in his book, Do Not Ask What Good We Do Inside the U.S. House of Representatives, a book that is vastly undernoted. This was a four-hour invitation-only meeting that had only two Republicans who were not elected officials. One was the Goebbels of the Republican Party, Frank Luntz, the propaganda master, and the other was the former head of the Republicans in the House, the last time they really controlled the House, Newt Gingrich. And but in addition to those two not elected Republicans, were Congressman Paul Ryan. You know him as the head of the Budget Committee, the guy who said, let's turn Medicare into a voucher program, and who ran for vice president. He was rewarded for this effort by giving the vice president slot. Congressman Eric Cantor, the number two Republican in the House of Representatives, that guy who's always standing behind John Boehner with that little stiletto tickling Boehner's kidney. Representative Kevin McCarthy, the number three Republican in the House of Representatives, the guy who counts the votes and make sure that the agenda is done. Congressman Pete Sessions from Texas, Congressman Jeb Hensarling from Texas, Congressman Pete Hoekstra, these are all Republicans from Michigan, Congressman Dan Lundgren from Michigan, and then five members of the United States Senate, Jim DeMint, who is now running the Heritage Foundation next door to us, making $1 million or $2 million a year. Was it $1 million or $2 million? I forget how much, but he's making seven figures. You know, they pay these guys well when they've done their job. Jim DeMint, John Kyle, the Republican from Arizona, John McCain's colleague. Tom Coburn, Dr. No, the representative, the Republican from Oklahoma. John Ensing, the Republican ensign, the Republican from Nevada, who got caught up in the sex scandal and is no more a Republican from Nevada in any case. And Senator Bob Corker, the Republican from Tennessee. And these guys, they actually used the language, well, here, this is Pete Sessions in talking to the National Journal. Taliban insurgency, he said. Now, keep in mind, Americans are losing 750,000 jobs a month at this time. And these guys wanted to keep it that way so Obama would get blamed for it. Taliban insurgency. I'm quoting Pete Sessions, Congressman Pete Sessions. We understand perhaps a little bit more because of the Taliban. Insurgency is the way they went about systematically understanding how to disrupt and change a person's entire processes. And these Taliban is an example of how you go about to change a person from their messaging to their operations to their frontline message. And we need to understand that insurgency may be required when dealing with the other side. In other words, us Republicans, we be the Taliban. He went on to say, If the Democrats do not give us those options or opportunities, then we will become insurgency. I think insurgency is a mindset and an attitude that we're going to have to search for and find ways to get our message out and be prepared to see things for what they are rather than trying to do something about them. In other words, maintain the status quo. 750,000 jobs lost every month. Make the Depression worse and worse and worse and worse and worse. And these guys voted no on every stimulus package that came down the road. Kevin McCarthy, Congressman Kevin McCarthy, number three Republican in the House of Representatives. He said, we got to challenge them on every single bill. We have to show united and unyielding opposition to the president's economic policies. No help for the American people, basically. Now, all of these guys, when Bush was president, had voted yes on the January 2008 stimulus. They had voted yes to bail out Bear Stearns. They had voted yes to bail out AIG. They had voted yes to the September 2008 TARP. And they had voted yes to the October 2008 TARP. All of them voted against every effort by President Obama to do anything even close to the same. They all voted for the two wars without a budget, without any means to pay for them during the Bush administration. They all voted for the top tax cut for the top 1% that ran up $4 trillion in debt. No way to pay for it. I mean, these guys voted for all of this thing, all of this stuff. They filibustered more than 300 bills, more than any other Congress in history. They voted no on every single piece of legislation brought to the floor, including Al Franken's anti-rape amendment, Lilly Ledbetter on the Fair Pay Act, the anti-outsourcing bill. No on increasing FEMA during natural disasters. I mean, that's how committed these guys were as an insurgency.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
They said they were going to use the Taliban as their model. Well, they did. So, are the Republicans meeting tonight? What are they planning? And what are your hopes and fears for the next 4 years? Welcome back, fair and only slightly unbalanced, the Tom Hartman Program. We, clip number five, we need to seize this moment together.
My fellow Americans, we are made for this moment, and we will seize it so long as we seize it together.
Are there four we's in there? I mean, this is just all about we. Clip number six.
Understand that our country cannot succeed when a shrinking few do very well and a growing many barely make it. We believe that America's prosperity must rest upon the broad shoulders of a rising middle class. We know that America thrives when every person can find independence and pride in their work, when the wages of honest labor liberate families from the brink of hardship. We are true to our creed when a little girl born into the bleakest poverty knows that she has the same chance to succeed as anybody else because she is an American, she is free, and she is equal, not just in the eyes of God, but also in our own.
There you go. Victor in New York, New York City. Hey, Victor. You had some thoughts on Obama's use of the word we?
Yes, I do, Tom, and thank you for taking my phone call. The thing is that what Obama was saying, he's saying, I set out a platform for y'all. This is what I plan to do, but it's up to us.
Yep.
We.
Yep.
We need to take care of this. We need to do this together, all of us, because the whole big thing is that the Republicans, just like they turned their star upside down, they reverse other things. And what they reversed is you took the W from we and turned it upside down into me. It's a plural thing. It's only about the 1%. You know, what I call, not the 1%, I call them the greedy. And they're like the new Robin Hood. I call them robbing the hood. And their logo is steal from the needy, give to the greedy. That's what I'm saying. He's saying to all of us, listen, I will do my job, but you have to do your job too. You have to step up and let your congresspeople know this is what you want. We as a plural, not as a singular, not as a 1%.
Yep.
So I just want to thank you for your taking my call. Thank you, Tom.
Sure. Yeah. And Victor, it's good to know that as somebody's on the same wavelength as me, that I've tapped into something. I have to say, I have not seen or read any commentary about Obama's speech. I watched his speech at home, and then Louise and I ran down to the subway, and it was kind of a convoluted subway ride to get here to the radio studio. And then I had to edit a whole bunch of stuff for the TV show tonight. And I finally got around to reading the speech about 15 minutes before we went on the air. I'd watched it on television, but I have no idea what the networks are saying, what other commentators are saying, what the blogs are saying. I'm just sharing with you my take on it. Kirk in Bothell, Washington, listening on 91.3 FM. Hey, Kirk. Thanks for joining us. So what's on your mind? You wanted to...
Well, I can tell you the commentary that I've heard this morning. I was listening to NPR until I could listen to 91.3 and hear you. And the nattering nabobs of the right and Senator Jeff Flake from Arizona were criticizing the president for not offering enough olive branches. And after what you just said in the last break about the caucus room strategy session, why would he? Why would any smart man make that mistake twice?
Yeah, I mean, he has to know by now. In fact, when Robert Draper's book was published, I'm sure, you know, somebody stuck it in front of him and said, hey, look at what was going on the night that you were, you know, the night that you were dancing at Union Station with your wife and Tom Hartman and Ellen Ratner. Because we were there at the inaugural ball. And he has to know that there was this conspiracy that was put together by Paul Ryan and Sessions and you know, all these other John Kyle and these other Republicans to basically destroy his presidency. And I think when he took the oath of office yesterday, which is what the Constitution mandates, in a quiet private ceremony, and then he said to his youngest daughter, "I did it." You know, it's like, hey, you know, we beat them, we got past them. So very interesting. So the Republicans are whining that they're not getting enough olive branches. That's ripe. Kirk, thank you for sharing that with us. I appreciate it. And thanks for listening to 91.3 FM. Richard in Monclova, Ohio. Hey, Richard. Happy MLK Day, too, by the way. I am. I hope you are well.
Good. Hey, on this day when our first black president is being inaugurated on Martin Luther King Day, I think one of my hopes and dreams for the next 4 years is that we have a strategic withdrawal of our troops from the war on drugs.
Yes.
Which to me has been, in effect, a war on urban black youth.
Yeah, even though white teenagers use more drugs than anybody else in America, young black people are far more likely to be arrested for them.
Yeah, I've got a study that was published in the Archives of General Psychiatry. 9% of whites have severe white youth have severe drug problems, and 5% of African Americans and blacks are arrested at a rate 10 times greater than whites, and sentencing is also way off the chart.
Disproportionately severe. Yeah, you're absolutely right. Go ahead.
Oh, I just, you know, so, you know, on this day that when race is in front of us, I think it is something that we really ought to be talking about.
Yeah, I think, and Martin Luther King, when he was assassinated, Nixon's war on drugs really hadn't come into its own as it has today. I believe that he would be speaking out as strongly against the so-called war on drugs as he was speaking out against the war in Vietnam. And yes, this is also, and thank you very much, Richard, thank you for the call. This is also Martin Luther King Day, and this is also the anniversary of Citizens United. So here we have the Citizens United decision. 3 years ago? It was 3 years ago, wasn't it, Shane? Yeah, 3 years ago today. And today we're honoring the memory and the birthday of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King. God bless him. And it's also the day that our nation's first African-American president is sworn into office for the second time. Remarkable. Ron in Parker, Colorado, listening on AM 760. Hey, Ron.
Hello.
Hey, you're on the air, Ron.
Oh, hi, Tom. How you doing? Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Say, Tom, I was thinking about the meeting that the Republican senators had on inauguration night.
Yeah, it was congressmen and senators. It was both. Yeah.
Oh, congressmen and senators. Yeah. And I'm just thinking, isn't that a form of treason or the height of anti-Americanism?
Well, I call it a political treason. I don't know that it's legal
treason.
But it's certainly political treason.
Yes, yes, I agree. I mean, after all, the president was just inaugurated. We didn't know what his agenda was. And they blocked a lot of times their own initiatives, and they went against the will of the people, and President Obama being elected as the will of the people. So, yes, definitely political treason.
Yeah, yeah, I'm totally with you, Ron. And that's why the question that I'm wondering is, you know, 3 years from now, is Robert Draper going to write another book in which he tells us that tonight, instead of going to the big balls and things, you know, the dances and whatnot, this same group of Republicans met at, you know, another restaurant. I don't know which one. I doubt they'll go back to the caucus room because, you know, probably me and Jim and Shane and Danielle and Louise and Robin are going to go over there tonight and check it out. You know, it's like, you got any private rooms we can stick our nose into? Anyhow, we'll find out. Ron, thanks a lot for the call. Todd in Kirkland, Washington. Hey, Todd, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's up?
Yeah, we get to watch you here on in the Seattle Public Access. We don't have Free Speech TV, but courageously, the people downtown put your show on for us.
God bless them.
Yeah. So I just wanted to give a personal story. You know, I've always been Mr. Healthy. I never had any health problems. And last month, I just got up one morning, and I bent over to put on my clothes, and I had a stabbing pain in my back, which turned out to be a ruptured disc in my spine.
Ouch.
And, boy, if that ain't painful, I'll tell you. This is, and, you know, the reason I'm calling is thank God for Obamacare and that we're making progress in this country for people to get treatment for this kind of thing.
Uh-huh.
Because I can just imagine there must be millions of people laying in absolute agony because they're not able to get health care for various things like this, which are treatable, you know, if you can get access to the clinics and things downtown.
Yeah. Yeah, that's so. Yes, and Obamacare. You know, as much as, gee, wouldn't it be nice to have a public option? Wouldn't it be nice if it was single payer? Quack, 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 quack. It opens the door to all that stuff. And as Bernie Sanders pointed out on the program on Friday, when he had Peter Shumlin on as our guest, the governor of the state of Vermont, Vermont has already passed the law for single payer in the state of Vermont, and it'll go into effect in 2014 or 2016 as soon as they can get a waiver from the federal government. So, good one. Thank you, Todd, for sharing that. Jerry, WWRL in New York City, in Amityville. You are in Amityville. Jerry,
yes,
60 seconds to the 1 minute to the break. It's yours.
Okay, yes, sure. With respect to Obama's inaugural speech, I slightly disagree with you in the sense that I was disappointed with him in two respects. First of all, he failed to mention gun control. And secondly...
Well, he did, actually. He mentioned, you know, that we owe the children of Newtown peace and security.
Well, he just mentioned making children safe, but I wish he had elaborated a little bit further. And also, in the light of everything that's happened politically over the last 4 years, it makes no sense for me, in my opinion, for Obama to try to find common ground, a common purpose with people who live on another planet, so to speak. And I think the best way to balance the federal budget is on the backs of the middle class and poor social.
I get it, Jerry. I absolutely get it. And I don't disagree with you. On the other hand, as often as he reaches out the olive branch and as often as he says, let's have good government and let's work together, and they say no and they slap it away, that's how often the American people are going to wake up and get it, that these guys are toxic. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
45 minutes past the hour. What are your hopes for the next 4 years? One of mine to start out with is that Obamacare will come into fruition and become a single-payer system. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Wow, I'm looking at this footage that Jim is showing on the screen right now. And President Obama and Michelle actually got out of the cars and walked down Pennsylvania Avenue, something we haven't seen since Jimmy Carter. So that's a big deal. That's you know why that's such a big deal to me is that by stepping out of the cars and walking down the street in public with this, you know, all the people lining the streets and you didn't have to go through 16 levels of Chertoff X-ray porno scanners to get into any, nobody had to go through a Chertoff X-ray porno scanner to stand, you know, 30 feet from the president. You have to do it to get out of an airplane, don't you? Don't ask me to explain why. I don't know. But actually, you know, they're taking the Chertoff X-ray porno scanners out of the airports. They're replacing them with these new millimeter wave scanners that are relatively new technology. So, we had X-ray machines. I remember in the early 50s as a little kid, I used to go into the shoe store down the street from my house or down the street from my school, actually, and wiggle my toes and watch the bones in my toes move as I had my foot in the machine. And now we know, 40 years later, 50 years later, that causes cancer. We don't yet know if this millimeter wave radiation will cause anything. So 30 or 40 years from now, we'll find out. But in any case, what this says to me when the president gets out of the car and walks in public like this is the exact opposite of the main message of the Bush-Cheney administration. The main message of the Bush-Cheney administration was be afraid, be very afraid. We're afraid, you should be afraid. That was the message that the Bush and Cheney, these two frightened little men, put out constantly, is how terrified they were. And they were so terrified that they had to create this incredible national security state, and they had to go bomb other people and kill other people in other countries because they were terrified. And President Obama and his wife walking down the street are basically saying, we're not afraid. And frankly, there has not been a president, I think, since Franklin Roosevelt, who has been so hated by the right. I mean, they were, Fred Koch, dad, the Koch brothers, Charles and David Koch's dad, Fred Koch, who helped start the John Birch Society, helped pay for signs all over the United States that said impeach Earl Warren, and that there was this whole anti-Kennedy thing that came out of the John Birch Society and Fred Koch. But Jack Kennedy was not hated with the passion that Barack Obama's hated. Jack Kennedy at least was a white guy. He was a Catholic, and there were a lot of Protestants back at that time. There still are, who are bigots against Catholics. But that's nothing compared to the bigotry against an African American. And here he is saying, I am not afraid. God bless him. David in Loves Park, Illinois. Hey, David, you are running for political office?
Yes, sir. Yeah, no, I called you about a month or so ago and told you I would give you kind of a call back to kind of update you on my campaign, what's been going on. And just so you know, about a couple of days after I called your show, I got my petitions in, moved on, and went on with life. And on January 7th, just a couple weeks ago, I got word that my petitions were being challenged, not because there was anything wrong with my petitions, but because I had failed to secure my petition papers with a staple.
With a staple. Oh, my.
With a staple. And, yeah, and I had to go through a hearing. And
amazing.
The bottom line is,
David, you're back running for political office. Do you have a website you want to point people out to? Because I'd like to get some more calls in here. What is it?
Well, yeah, and I know you had other callers, and I was going to say I have a full blog that describes that.
Okay, where can people find it, David?
www.electdavidsoll.com, and that's S-O-L-L.
Okay, great. Thank you very much, David. Good luck. I wish you the very best. Diane in Milford, Mass. Hey, Diane.
Hey, how you doing?
Great. You wanted to talk about the president walking outside his car?
Yes, I thought that was wonderful. I'm glad you brought it up. You're right. There could have been somebody 30 feet away that could have taken his life. And to be honest with you, with this being Martin Luther King's birthday and Barack Obama having his inaugural today as an African-American woman, this has been a very stirring moment.
Mm.
Unfortunately, I was a little bit disappointed in his inaugural speech because it didn't seem to have much substance. He seemed to say a lot, but it didn't say exactly what he was going to do.
Well, he's going to do that in the State of the Union address in 3 weeks. The inaugural address defines the frames. It creates the picture frame, as it were. Here's how we view the world. And then the picture that goes in that frame, that comes with the State of the Union address. And he did what he was
supposed to. I've been watching politics for a long time, and I should have known that.
If you go back and you read the inaugural addresses, I mean, Lincoln's second inaugural is considered one of the most famous speeches in history. And he didn't have any specific calls for action. in there. He was calling to heal the nation, basically.
That would certainly make sense.
Yeah.
In this particular situation, I think we need healing in the nation as well.
I agree.
Especially, I was really surprised he didn't say anything about the gun violence.
He did indirectly. He said that the children of Newtown, Connecticut. He mentioned Newtown, Connecticut. In fact, here's the. Let me find the exact phrase here. Here we go. He said, our journey is not complete until all of our children, from the streets of Detroit to the hills of Appalachia to the quiet lanes of Newtown, know that they are cared for and cherished and always safe from harm. Now, if that's not a call for doing something about what happened in Newtown, in other words, gun violence, I don't know what is. Again, the State of the Union or the inaugural speech is not the place where you say, here's my 6-point plan. But I think he shouted out pretty emphatically. The inaugural address is all about subtlety. And this was short and subtle and very straightforward. And the main frame is we are in this together. We are all responsible for Newtown's children, which means that we all have a responsibility to act, to do something. So I thought that was pretty brilliant, actually. Diane, thank you for your call. And thanks for watching. And Free Speech TV there in Milford, Massachusetts. We'll be back. It is coming up on the top of the hour here. Back with more of your thoughts and mine about the president's speech. And you're not going to believe what Charles Krauthammer, one of the leading commentators on Fox so-called news, just said about this. I'll share that with you right after the news.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back to the second hour of our program. It is Martin Luther King, the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday. It is incredibly appropriately the day of the second inaugural of the first African-American to be president of the United States, Barack Hussein Obama. And I think that, in a way, this is even more historic. I Louise and I had this conversation with a cab driver last week. The first election, 3 million people showed up in this town. We're broadcasting live from D.C. I was living in Portland at the time, but I came out here for it. And Ellen Ratner, our dear friend of the Talk Radio News Service, who knows everybody and has got, she's just like wired into the press corps here, got me a press pass that literally, I was maybe 100 feet at the most from the president as he was sworn in, on the Congress building, right at the same level with, Bush and Congress and the Supreme Court and everybody. They were all just, could have thrown a gum wrapper at them. It was just, they were right there. And it was an amazing, amazing thing. And I just thought, this is amazing. This is historic. Our first African-American president. And not only that, a reasonably progressive guy who ran on a progressive platform and a Democrat and all that, just a lot of hope and a lot of joy. This time around, not as many people showed up. I don't know if the crowd estimates are in yet. They were anticipating about 1 million instead of 3 million. And some people, I think there were some people like myself who went to the first one and felt like, okay, been there, done that, still have the tux. But the question is it possibly even more historic? Because it's like we're saying, okay, we had the first African American president, and he did a really good job, and we reelected him over a white billionaire, and in the face of hundreds of millions of dollars of cash from other white billionaires who were trying to buy the election. And not to say that it's all about race, I think it's frankly more about ideology as well. But I'm putting this in the context of Martin Luther King's birthday. I think Dr. King would, I don't even want to put words in his mouth. I'm certainly not qualified or justified to do that. In my opinion, the second election is even more historic than the first. The first is damn historic, but the second one is the one in which we said, you know, we the people of the United States didn't just elect an African-American as president of the United States, but we reelected him. This is a BFD, to paraphrase Joe Biden. Now, the second inaugural speech, you know, it's not frequent that I agree with Fox so-called news and their out-of-control commentators. But Charles Krauthammer went off on a screed just in the last hour or so about the inaugural speech. And you know, you heard me in my first hour talking about it. I said I think that, you know, he used the word we over and over and over again. He is trying to take us back from the absolute and utter destruction of America that was Reaganomics and the Reagan worldview. And I say that very advisedly because America is we the people. Our government is us. We are our government. That's what's unique about America. And then Reagan came along as a politician and said, government's the problem. I'm sorry. We're the government. You're saying we're the problem? And we own the government. We created the, Reagan was essentially saying that, you know, what George Washington had three horses shot out from underneath him fighting for is bad. What Thomas Jefferson and you know, 42 other guys put their signatures on a document, as they recall the number 43, whatever, you know, signed this document, the Declaration of Independence, which immediately subject all of them to arrest and hanging by the British, that what they did was create something that was bad. And that's been the prevailing meme for the last 30 plus years, is that government is somehow awful. And that we should not put our faith and trust in the government that we created, that we fought and died for, that we defended for over 200 years. We should not do that, according to Reaganomics and the right wing and the Republican perspective. No, instead, we should be putting our faith and trust in the billionaires, the so-called free market that they own and control. Let the banksters regulate the banks. They're overregulated. Let the oil companies regulate the oil companies. Let the drug companies sell whatever they damn well please. Get your damn hands off the tobacco companies. This is the pitch of Fox so-called news and the libertarians and the Republicans and the hate America crowd, the hate government crowd, hating government, hating America. I mean, our government is America. America is our government. This is, by the way, those of you watching us on television, we're showing real-time images here. Is that the president out of the car walking again? Oh, he's at the White House. He's out, yep, right in front of the White House. And there's all those people. And I'd say, you know, once again, this is, you know, he got out of the car and he's walking down the street like Jimmy Carter did with Rosalynn back in the day. And this is a president saying, you know, George and Dick, you guys were frightened little guys, and I'm not. But anyhow, Charles Krauthammer went off on one of his anti-American screeds, anti-government screeds. And in this, I agree with his analysis. I think Obama's second inaugural speech said, we, the people, we are going to reclaim our government. We are going to make our government work. We are going to make our government a good and noble force in the world. And through this thing that we have fought and died for centuries, we are going to make the world and this country a better place. And of course, that would explode the head of anybody who is a toady for the billionaires who would like to replace our government, who would like to privatize Social Security, voucherize Medicare, and destroy the institutions of our government. Here's Charles Krauthammer on Fox News just a few minutes ago.
And I think what's most interesting is that Obama basically is declaring the end of Reaganism in this speech. Remember, he once said that Ronald Reagan was historically consequential in a way that Bill Clinton was not. And what Obama meant is that Obama had changed the ideological course of the country. In 1981, in his inaugural address, within 2 minutes, Reagan had declared that government is not the solution, government is the problem. Today's inaugural address was a rebuke to that entire idea. This speech today was an ode to big government. It was a hymn to big government.
Yes, it was a hymn to the government that George Washington fought and was willing to die for. It was a hymn to the government that the men who signed the Declaration of Independence each independently was willing to die for, and many of them lost everything over. It was a hymn to the people who fought in the Revolutionary War. It was a hymn to the framers who created the Constitution of the United States. It was a hymn to Dolly Madison rescuing the portrait of George Washington as the Canadians and the British marched into Washington, D.C. to set fire to the White House in the War of 1812. It was a hymn to Abraham Lincoln, who fought to keep this nation together. That was the speech that President Obama gave, and that is infuriating the Republican toadies of the billionaires who want to replace government in our lives, who want to say, no, you are beholden to the banks. You are beholden to the pharmaceutical companies. You are beholden to the health insurance companies. You can control your own destiny by electing your representatives and creating programs that you can change by changing your representatives. Oh, no. Government is a terrible thing. George Washington made a horrible mistake. Right. I think that this was a brilliant speech. I am just so impressed. And we'll pick up on the other side of this break with your thoughts on that as well. Stay tuned.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Isn't that amazing? Me and Charles Krauthammer agreeing. Yeah, what is this world coming to? Welcome back. 20 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, and Armin in Bradenton, Florida. Hey, Armin, your thoughts on the inaugural address?
I think, and I hope, and I pray, and I believe that Obama very much has the capabilities. That's not the question. The questions are, does he have the character, the integrity, and the backbone in the second term to stand up against the corporate globalist bankster interest that have stripped out the spirit of so many common people in this country for so long with so many presidents before him?
You missed one thing.
I'd like to... What?
You missed, does he have the popular support to do it? Because without the popular support, no president
yes,
can
does.
Do it. And with the popular support, no president can avoid doing it.
And may I say one other thing, please, Tom, respectfully? You know Laura Flanders.
I don't. Yeah, I do. Yeah.
She's very intelligent, and I don't agree with her on some things. But she said it most elegantly recently. She had a column. And what she said, and she's supposed to be this bleeding heart liberal, and nobody said it better than her. She says, before we do anything else with weapons and guns, let's background check the Pentagon and see where those weapons are going and stop them from being used against our own children that we send over to the Mideast in these terrible, unnecessary wars.
Yeah, I'm with you, Armin. It's time to audit the Pentagon and severely restrict their budget. Thanks for the call. Dave in Arcata, California, listening on AM 1480. You wanted to correct me. You said several presidents have stepped out of the car in mid-route?
Yeah, that was what I initially wanted to call you about, but there's a delay. And, Tom, I'm... A day that goes back to you, day one, a mutual friendship with my late neighbor, Alice, and I'm also Bertrand Russell in your chat room.
Uh-huh.
Yes, several of the other presidents have also stepped out of the car, at least a short distance, but I'm real concerned. I've been so active with Occupy and the need for the people to have some voice, a way to stand up to what they're up against, and I see it as far more devastating than most. I think that we're up against a dreadfully corrupt administration that regularly rigs elections and invades our personal place wherever they choose to do it. And I know you contemplate it, you think about it, don't want to be an actual conspiracist and say, yes, I know they do it, but I think... You have but to become aware.
There's no doubt in my mind, Dave, that, for example, Don Siegelman, you know, went to bed with the election having been decided in his favor and that a Republican got into the voting machine and added 15,000 votes to his opponent. And by the way, nobody down ticket, none of those votes flipped. None of the other Democrats on the ticket flipped to Republican, just the governor. It was an obvious vote rigging, vote grab in the 2002 election, and it's not the only one. There are other examples of it. So yeah, I don't consider that conspiracy nut stuff. It's well documented. We need to go back to using paper. Marty in Encinitas, California. Hey, Marty.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call. I have just a brief comment about something I noticed during the president's inaugural address. Mm-hmm. He mentioned the importance and the need of education to produce workers. And what occurred to me is we're missing the piece of producing thinkers. And that's my comment.
Yeah, well, that's a brilliant one, and it's one of the reasons, I agree. It's also one of the reasons we need not just workers and thinkers, we need musicians and artists, and it's why, you know, having music and art and physical therapy and philosophy and you know, a wide variety, the old-fashioned liberal arts curriculum needs to be in our public schools. Very, very well said, Marty. Thanks for calling and sharing that. Michael in Brookline, Massachusetts. Hey, Michael.
No, it's a pleasure to listen to you, but this is not what I'm calling about. I'm calling about a little different than the inaugural. I'm calling about why it is that the right goes so crazy over the debt, and it's not what you've heard. Obviously, they want to cut programs. But at high levels, but not astronomical levels of debt, like the GDP like now or like World War II. This is, in fact, good news for the American economy, and there's a reason for it. It's not obvious. What it is that the Federal Reserve controls the interest rates in the country, and before anything, they have rules about what they're supposed to do, but the number one thing that the Federal Reserve has to do is to keep the government solvent. Mm-hmm. Were the interest rates to go up to 6 or 7% today, the federal government, in all actuality, could go broke, and there would be social revolution, as they couldn't pay for police, they couldn't pay for anything.
Because of the cost of debt service, you mean?
Because of the debt service is high, yeah, because the GDP is
low. The flip side of that, though, is that, you know, after 2 or 3 years of that, the actual value of our national debt would be decreased substantially.
Well, if there's inflation, that's actually good from the standpoint of the people who are paying the debt. But meanwhile, the interest rates are kept low.
Right.
This happened actually before. This is just not now. This is what was going on during the Eisenhower administration and early into the Kennedy administration. And the net effect is that the banksters, the crooks, can't make huge profits by doing nothing. Yes, the Fed for a time can give them free loans, but that's not going to last forever. The net effect of which is that basically the bankster class hates high level of GDP, the debt. They don't give a damn about private debt. Nobody's saying, let's put a cap on credit card interest, or let's not allow people to borrow heads over heels. They're interested in the government debt because the government debt base, high levels of government debt forces low levels of interest, which forces lowers their profits in the long run, and it also makes it more advantageous to invest as opposed to just clip coupons and earn interest.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Michael, thank you for the call. It would take a while to deconstruct that, and it not being the topic of this hour, I don't have the time to unravel it all. It's 27 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
I think at the top of my list for this year, this coming year, is to strengthen and make sure Social Security and Medicare. Welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, and it is Martin Luther King's birthday. It is Martin Luther King Day, in which we honor the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., his life, and the fact that he was willing to stand up to injustice, even injustice perpetrated in the name of government, in the name of we the people, in a nonviolent fashion. I find this so inspiring and so important. Just think about this for a minute. There was some right winger. I've got the story around here someplace, but his name we need not say. Some right winger last week who was going off on this, saying, "Well, you know, if Martin Luther King had only had a Bushmaster, they would have gotten their rights a whole lot faster." And I would say to you, no. No. There were, you know, there were some people who tried that in the 70s. I remember. Didn't try it all that. It just, you know, the Symbionese Liberation Army and let's, you know, kidnap Patty Hearst and go rob a bank. And it just, you know, it didn't work. The moral power of Martin Luther King's work was rooted in his commitment to nonviolence. And his work was not just about freeing African Americans and establishing equality for all, but freeing poor whites as well, giving everybody the right to a union, ending the war in Vietnam. He was very outspoken about this. This got the FBI was all over Martin Luther King because of the war in Vietnam. And I mean, he was an extraordinary man. So today we honor his birthday. And today we watch reverently, speaking for myself, with tears in their eyes over at Fox so-called news, but reverently here as the President of the United States is inaugurated and gives this brilliant speech, this call to action to seize this moment together. We cannot do it alone. Clip number four, Shane. This is the frame. I mean, over and over and over again, you'll find this is the frame. But here's the president speaking.
"For the American people can no more meet the demands of today's world by acting alone than American soldiers could have met the forces of fascism or communism with muskets and militias. No single person can train all the math and science teachers we'll need to equip our children for the future, or build the roads and networks and research labs that will bring new jobs and businesses to our shores. Now, more than ever, we must do these things together as one nation and one people."
We. I mean, that was the frame. That was the frame, and it was brilliant. Warren in Kirkland, Washington, listening to 91.3 FM. Hey, Warren.
Hey, Tom. There's a part of Obama's speech I actually wish you would have wrote. He mentioned life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and the only thing I don't think he expanded on was life. And I love it when you talk about you can't have a life unless you have your health.
Right.
I wish you would just do your little riff on that.
Sure.
And say it right now, and that should have been in the speech.
Okay. Thank you very much, Warren. Clip number two, I believe, is the one he's referring to. We'll find out. Here it is.
"Today we continue a never-ending journey to bridge the meaning of those words with the realities of our time."
Now, this is right after that. Well, he quoted the Declaration of Independence. He said, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And every other country in the world has acknowledged that we all have a right to our lives, to a right to life. And that the way that we acknowledge that right to life and the way that we support that right to life is by having a national health care system so that no person is denied health care. It's very straightforward stuff. Nobody is denied health care. So, I hope that's enough of the rant for you. It's so self-evident to me. Roxanne in Albuquerque, listening on AM 1350. Hey, Roxanne.
Hi. Very nice to talk with you. I just wanted to say that the part that struck me about the president's speech was when he equated his oath of office with the oath that's taken by the military and then our saying the Pledge of Allegiance, how it binds us all and makes us all responsible.
Yes. Yeah, that was toward the very end of his speech. He said, my fellow Americans, the oath I have sworn before you today, like the one recited by others who serve in this Capitol, was an oath to God and to country, not party or faction, and we must faithfully execute that pledge during the duration of our service. But the words I spoke today are not so different from the oath that is taken each time a soldier signs up for duty or an immigrant realizes her dream. My oath is not so different from the pledge we all make to the flag that waves above and fills our hearts with pride. They are the words of citizens, and they represent our greatest hope. You and I, as citizens, have the power to set this country's course. You and I, as citizens, have the obligation to shape the debates of our time, not only with the votes we cast, but with the voices we live in defense of our most ancient values and enduring ideals. And this is, again, that we the people frame, that large frame of all, we are all in this together. Thank you, Roxanne, for pointing that out. Very, very well done. Much appreciated. Sue in Canonsburg, Pennsylvania. Hey, Sue.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
This is so inspiring today. I'm 64. When I was 13, I made the march to get the Civil Rights Act enacted in Washington, Pennsylvania. The gentleman you see next to Martin Luther King, the Caucasian man, is Monsignor Charles Owens Rice. He was the pastor at my church.
Wow.
For 51 years, I've waited for all this to come to fruition. We can't stop the fight, and it is we, and every person we interact with is a part of that we. And we can affect change, and we can live long enough to see it happen. We may have to do it over and over and over again, but we can. And we never have to give up. And it doesn't make any difference how old we are, how young we are, what color we are. None of that matters. It's that we're the we, and we never give up, and we keep on doing the fight like you do, like I do, like so many people do every day. Yes, we need another Martin Luther King and another Monsignor Charles Owens Rice, but we can all be those people no matter what title we have.
Yes, and let me take it even a step further, Sue. What Martin Luther King did during his lifetime was not simply applaud when Lyndon Johnson signed the Civil Rights Act or the Voter Rights Act or, you know, when good things happened. He always said, and let's go a step farther, and let's go a step farther. And very often that was interpreted as criticism of the president, and sometimes it was criticism of the president. And yet that is the pushing. That is the make me do it. That is what is necessary in a democracy for a government to evolve and change and grow. And, you know, very well said, Sue. Thank you very much for the call. And very well said. Paula in Carbondale, Illinois. Hey, Paula.
Hi, Tom.
Nice
hey,
to hear
you. I only call to disagree with you, but I never get put at the front of the line.
Okay. So what do you want to disagree about?
Well, I wanted to quote a couple of Republicans. One of them, Charles Krauthammer, who said along, you know, 4 years ago about Obama, the liberals get the speech, but the conservatives get the policy. And I think that's what it is. He does give good speeches, but the conservatives get the policy. I'd like to quote George W. Bush, fool me once, shame on you. Fool me 4 years in a row, shame on you, or however it goes.
Well, I think that if John McCain had been president, Sonia Sotomayor would not be, or Elena Kagan would not be on the U.S. Supreme Court. We would not have a national health care system in place that has a backdoor in it that opens in 2014 and 2016 to allow any individual state to have single-payer health care, which is how Canada did it, and is, in my opinion, the very best way for it to happen. We wouldn't have had the Lilly Ledbetter Equal Pay Act. We wouldn't have had so many efforts, so many positive efforts that were shot down by the Republicans to make, you know, to bring our jobs back to the United States. I'm sure, Paula, there are many areas where you and I can agree that we wish the president hadn't gone there. You know, the drone strikes,
to destroy the global warming thing. I heard you selling your book, Last Days of Ancient Sunlight, which I have. And, you know, to shoot down the global warming agreement in Copenhagen, to open up public land to oil drilling, to approve so far the southern half of the Keystone Pipeline, these are not things that are going to help with our global warming problem.
I agree. And this is why, as I was just saying a moment ago, one of the things that we as citizens have an obligation to do which is not a negative toward government, is to speak out about our disagreements with the president as well as our agreements. And in the hopes that we can move him in that direction, because, and not just the president, every single member of Congress, if enough people speak, and thank you for the call, Paul, if enough people speak up about Keystone, if enough people, you know, speak up about the war in Afghanistan, and it's happening, by the way, with the war in Afghanistan, and it might, and frankly, I think Keystone XL would have been, you know, a done deal 2 years ago, 3 years ago, 4 years ago, had there not been as much resistance as there has been. But you know, those people who just sit back and think, oh, the president's going to be perfect. Sorry, that's not the real world.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
In the real world, the president and the members of the Senate and the House are political animals, and they respond to political pressure, which is you and me speaking out. And welcome back. Let's check in with Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, TalkRadioNews.com, brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com, where you can give a goat to help a rescued slave and receive a photo of your goat and the person you helped, and you may even find Ellen Ratner in the picture, because she started this whole thing, GoatsForTheOldGoat.com. Ellen, you are down at the parade?
I am at the parade, and it started very, very late, about 2 hours later than usual. People are shouting for Obama. I was also, along with your producer, Mr. Javinsky, in the front of the of what was going on today. My staff apparently caught me crying when the president was talking about Stonewall. Quite an amazing thing. Honestly, you know, my first gay march was in Labor Day 1970. Tom, I never thought it would happen. It's very interesting. The right is now placing all of this by saying that the president, you know, hit on all the right and all the things. Well, that's one way to look at it. And the other way is to talk about the fact that the president hit on human rights themes, not sticking his nose to the right wing.
Yeah, I agree. Fox News is sobbing in their beer. I mean, Charles Krauthammer, it was almost hysterical today. This is the end of the Reagan revolution. We are now going back to an era of big government. And I'm like, yeah.
How are human rights, which is what the president talked about a lot today, whether it's the right to health care, the right to gays, you know, the right to vote. How are human rights going to big government? I don't understand that, Tom.
Well, they want the billionaires to control all that stuff. They want the health insurance company to have say over life and death for us. They want the billionaires to be, you know, defining the congressional districts and owning the voting machines. I mean, you know, I it makes perfect sense to me, Ellen.
It is pretty amazing. And what's so interesting also just about what the president is planning on doing, both with this parade and you know, the balls tonight are very interesting, too, because there is a military ball and there is a ball that's the biggest ball of which they sold tickets to anybody that wanted to come. And even the parade today is really different than usual. Usually the parade is only for high donors, and there are high donors here. I'm not saying there aren't. But they gave parade tickets to different constituents. As the gay constituent, one of them, I got 4 parade tickets in a good place. So I know that there were, and when I stood in line to get those, there were people from all different communities across the country. This is very different. No matter what anybody's saying, the right is saying, well, this is just another rich person's or whatever. Even the Sunlight Foundation. Now, listen, I don't deny that there's some rich folks that came to this inaugural, but they were also very careful to give to people that normally would never get to go to anything like this.
That's
and
amazing.
Also, the other amazing thing today, the president did not mention in his speech, an entire section at the front for the Tuskegee Airmen.
Hmm.
I mean, this president really did think about a lot of those smaller constituents.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I thought, you know, just his mention of, I mean, there were words in here that most people probably didn't even get, Stonewall being one of them, that being the uprising in the gay bar in New York City, as I recall, was it not?
Yes, June 1969, the gays, they tried to arrest people on one of their sort of raids, you know, to round up the gays, and the gays fought back. Bricks, the riot went on a good part of the night. The next year was the first year of commemorative March, 1970. My first Stonewall parade was 1971.
There you go. And I'll bet for most people that just slipped right on by them.
Oh, I think it did.
Yeah.
It did. And again, I wasn't aware of it, but our staff caught me with tears in my eyes and took that picture. But I'll tell you, today really renewed my faith in the fact that the grassroots effort that you talk about, Tom, so often can really be an extreme force in American politics.
Well, and I think that throughout his speech, President Obama, I don't see the word I in here pretty much anywhere. I see the word we over and over and over and over and over again. And this is one of the things that has Charles Krauthammer so hysterical, is that President Obama kept talking about we rather than I, that instead of an imperial presidency, a Reagan-esque presidency, a George W. Bush kind of presidency, a one guy telling all of us, you know, how we should be presidency, he's calling all of us to step forward and participate and serve and be part of the country, be part of we the people. And,
you know, I was also at a off-the-record briefing the other day for the business people in the Obama administration. That was the gay lesbian briefing. And I have to tell you, they're very interested in engaging the middle of business. They're not, they want everybody on board, even people who normally would not do that.
In other words, small businesses, like the one that you
run
and the one that I run.
Exactly.
Wow. Wow. Yeah. And yeah, we don't have millions or billions to donate to any politician. And it's
right.
Great that they want to
hear
from us.
Right. You hear the parade going through us right now.
Uh-huh. It's going by you. Ellen, in the president got out of his car and walked for a ways in this parade. I thought that Jimmy Carter was the last to do that. One of our callers.
No, every president has done that, including Bush.
Oh, okay. Okay. So I stand corrected. Thank you.
The president's walk, and he does do that. So this is not at all uncommon. They have the bags there to make sure. No, it's been done from every time.
Okay, good, good. Well, it's good to have the facts right, and my apologies for not having them right. What 4 years ago today, or arguably yesterday, but 4 years ago, Inauguration Day, at the Caucus Room restaurant, you had this group of Republicans headed up by Paul Ryan, Eric Cantor, and Kevin McCarthy, and Tom Coburn and John Kyle and Jim DeMint, planning in this 4-hour private meeting at the Caucus Room restaurant to basically take down the Obama presidency by obstructing him for the next 4 years, which they did, although they were not successful in taking him down. They did obstruct a lot of good legislation. Do you think that these same people are going to have another conspiracy meeting someplace else in some other restaurant?
Oh, I'm sure
tonight?
They're going to try. In fact, you know, one of these guys on these bicycle things gave me a ride this morning and was telling me that an unnamed Republican was trying to hide that he was going to one of these meetings and hid in a trunk for 3 blocks till he evaded the press and got out.
Wait a minute. A Republican is going to one of the meetings where they're talking about how to frustrate the efforts of Obama over the next 4 years?
This was several years ago, yeah.
And he hid in a trunk?
Yes. I heard that this morning. I nearly fell out of the little van.
Was that on the way to the meeting at the caucus room 4 years ago today?
No, I didn't ask. I think it was actually in Georgetown.
Amazing. Amazing. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service. Wonderful to hear from you, Ellen.
Thank you.
And don't forget, goatsfortheoldgoat.com, Ellen's charity, and talkradionews.com, of course, as well. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And President Obama gave his second inaugural speech. And it was a doozy. What he did was he basically kicked Paul Ryan in the teeth. He basically said to Ayn Rand and all the libertarian America haters, the people who hate the concept of a government of the people, by the people, for the people, and who really want a government to be so small that they can drown it in the bathtub, to quote or paraphrase Grover Norquist. What he said to them is, no, we the people are here. We cannot do it alone. We are we together. Here, clip number 2 to start.
Today we continue a never-ending journey to bridge the meaning of those words with the realities of our time. For history tells us that while these truths may be self-evident, They've never been self-executing. That while freedom is a gift from God, it must be secured by his people here on earth.
And he continued to say, we can't do it alone. And this, I'm telling you, over at Fox News, they're having a meltdown right now because the president kept talking like this and, you know, saying, you know, we just can't, you know, just having the few billionaires isn't enough. Here he is. Clip number three.
The Patriots of 1776 did not fight to replace the tyranny of a king with the privileges of a few or the rule of a mob. They gave to us a republic, a government of and by and for the people, entrusting each generation to keep safe our founding creed. In four more than 200 years, we have.
Welcome back. And he just, this is it, right? I mean, there is no other way to describe it other than this defined the frame. I mean, this is what a state of the, or, I'm sorry, an inaugural speech is supposed to do, is, yes, I'm the president now, and here's how I view the world. Here's how I view my job. You only give that speech once, excuse me, once every 4 years. Hold on just a second. Pardon me. You only give that speech once every 4 years, and whereas you give a State of the Union address once a year. So it isn't so much a laundry list of, you know, a punch list, a to-do list. It's not that kind of thing. Instead, it is the vision. It is what is the purpose of government? It is why are we here? What are we doing? What are we all about? Do you have it? And let me just take you back to the days before Ronald Reagan came along and said, greed is good and government is the greatest evil. And, you know, government is the problem, not the solution, and all these kind of things. Back when America, when Americans understood America as it was. And I think that we're coming back around to that. This is from the 1960 presidential debate between Richard Nixon and John Kennedy. And the question was about the fact that in the South, African Americans were not allowed to sit at lunch counters with white people. What are we going to do about this? Now, just, you know, consider that for a moment and consider the answer that Nixon gives and then the answer that, which is basically, I'm just going to ask the business owners to behave like good people. And then the answer that Kennedy gives, which is, I'm going to take the law and whack them upside the head. In other words, Kennedy says, I'm going to use big government. Nixon says, I'm not going to use the government at all. I'm going to just jawbone. Right. Which is, you know, what they're all hysterical. They're on Fox News right now. And all the concern. This is what they want. Just consider how far we've come from this moment in 1960 in the presidential election, the debate between Richard Nixon and John F. Kennedy.
I have talked to Negro mothers. I've heard them try to explain how they tell their children how they can go into a store and buy a loaf of bread, but then can't go into that store and sit at the counter and get a Coca-Cola. This is wrong, and we have to do something about it. So under the circumstances, what do we do? Well, what we do is what the Attorney General of the United States did under the direction of the President. Call in the owners of chain stores and get them to take action.
In other words, basically ask them to be nice. Now, so then they turn the question to Kennedy. What are you going to do?
Senator Kennedy.
Well, Mr. Nixon hasn't discussed the two basic questions. What is going to be done and what will be his policy on implementing the Supreme Court decision of 1954? Giving aid to schools technically that are trying to carry out the decision is not the great question. Secondly, what's he going to do to provide fair employment? He's been the head of the Committee on Government Contracts. It's carried out two cases, both in the District of Columbia. He has not indicated his support of an attempt to provide fair employment practices around the country so that everyone can get a job regardless of their race or color. Nor has he indicated that he will support Title III, which would give the Attorney General additional powers to protect constitutional rights. These are the great questions. Equality of education in schools. About 2% of our population of white people is illiterate. 10% of our colored population. 60 to 70% of our colored children do not finish high school. These are the questions in these areas that the North and the Southeast and West are entitled to know. What will be the leadership of the president in these areas to provide equality of opportunity for employment? Equality of opportunity in the field of housing, which could be done on all federal-supported housing by a stroke of the president's pen. What will be done to provide equality of education in all sections of the United States? Those are the questions to which the president must establish a moral tone and moral leadership. And I can assure you that if I'm elected president, we will do so.
And he did. And it led right to Lyndon Johnson signing the Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Act. And it led right to the Reagan presidency saying, oh, no, enough of that already. In fact, it led to Ronald Reagan giving his first speech when he was running for president of the United States, his very first speech after the nominating convention had anointed him as the Republican nominee for president of the United States, to going to Philadelphia, Mississippi, where three civil rights workers had been brutally tortured and murdered, and giving a speech, a little town of 6,000 people in Mississippi, and giving a speech on the importance of states' rights, which, of course, was code for let's go back to Nixon's way of doing things. Keep in mind, Nixon had been vice president for 8 years during the 50s. Very different worldview. And now we're back to, if you can pull up clip number five and then number six here, Shane. This from the president. Today, the President of the United States.
My fellow Americans, we are made for this moment, and we will seize it so long as we seize it together.
Now, are you getting a sense of an arc of history just in our lifetimes? I mean, I'm old enough to remember this arc. Many of you are not, but there is an arc of history here, a recent one that is extraordinary. Clip number six.
Understand that our country cannot succeed when a shrinking few do very well, and a growing many barely make it. We believe that America's prosperity must rest upon the broad shoulders of a rising middle class. We know that America thrives when every person can find independence and pride in their work, when the wages of honest labor liberate families from the brink of hardship. We are true to our creed when a little girl born into the bleakest poverty knows that she has the same chance to succeed as anybody else because she is an American, she is free, and she is equal, not just in the eyes of God, but also in our own.
There you go. So do we have time for clip number 13, or are we? It's 36 seconds. We don't have time for that. Okay, we'll play that when we come back from the break. Actually, as we go into the break here. And then we're going to pick up your phone calls as well. 15 minutes past the hour. The President of the United States, Mr. Barack Obama, President Barack Obama, inaugurated for the second time. Thus begins a new four-year presidency with the hopes of the nation behind it. And the fears of the conservatives. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Can you imagine how Fox would have gone after Jack Kennedy during the Kennedy-Nixon debates, had there been a Fox back then? Occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. There's a photo that our video director and associate producer Jim Javinsky took this morning as he stood by the president and the vice president. That was great. Welcome back. That's a great, great picture. Here is today, of course, the birthday of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and some of his thoughts on his hopes for what I would like to think was today.
So even though we face the difficulties of today and tomorrow, I still have a dream. Yes. It is a dream deeply rooted in the American dream. I have a dream that one day this nation will rise up, live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. I have a dream that one day on the red hills of Georgia, the sons of former slaves and the sons of former slave owners will they be able to sit down together at the table of brotherhood? I have a dream.
There you go. And clip 13, the President of the United States today in his second inaugural address.
We, the people, declare today that the most evident of truths, that all of us are created equal, is the star that guides us still. Just as it guided our forebears through Seneca Falls and Selma and Stonewall, just as it guided all those men and women, sung and unsung, who left footprints along this great mall, to hear a preacher say that we cannot walk alone, to hear a king proclaim that our individual freedom is inextricably bound to the freedom of every soul on earth.
So there you have Martin Luther King speaking of the future and Barack Obama speaking of Martin Luther King. To hear that preacher speak. Right? Powerful, powerful stuff. Clip number 14, if you can.
For our journey is not complete until our wives, our mothers, and daughters can earn a living equal to their efforts. Our journey is not complete until our gay brothers and sisters are treated like anyone else under the law. For if we are truly created equal, then surely the love we commit to one another must be equal as well. Our journey is not complete until no citizen is forced to wait for hours to exercise the right to vote. Our journey is not complete until we find a better way to welcome the striving, hopeful immigrants who still see America as a land of opportunity. Until bright young students and engineers are enlisted in our workforce rather than expelled from our country. Our journey is not complete until all our children, from the streets of Detroit to the hills of Appalachia to the quiet lanes of Newtown, know that they are cared for and cherished and always safe from harm.
The children of Newtown, safe from harm. Remarkable. Clip 16 and 17. Let's share these. This is, we must act knowing that our work is going to be imperfect, but we begin. Here's clip 16.
We must act knowing that our work will be imperfect. We must act knowing that today's victories will be only partial, and that it will be up to those who stand here in 4 years and 40 years and 400 years hence to advance the timeless spirit once conferred to us in a spare Philadelphia hall.
And clip number 17.
You and I, as citizens, have the power to set this country's course. You and I, as citizens, have the obligation to shape the debates of our time, not only with the votes we cast, but with the voices we lift in defense of our most ancient values and enduring ideals.
All he had to say was tag, you're it, you know? I mean, it's like, there it is. Marty in Evergreen Park, Illinois, listening to WCPT. Hey, Marty.
Hey, Tom, thanks for taking my call. I was going to comment on the inauguration speech, which I was able to listen to today. And I was going to say that last clip that you played out where, you know, he went and mentioned, working pay for women and, you know, gay equality and jobs for undocumented immigrants, all of that compounded in that short paragraph I thought was really impressive, inspiring, and just moving. I thought it was a great part of his speech.
Yeah, I thought this was soaring rhetoric. I mean, this speech was it's going to be damn hard to live up to this stuff. And as he said in that last clip that you heard, it's up to us. You know, he said you and me. Right. In other words, we're all in this together. We're all going to have to work on it together. But excellent point, Marty. Thank you very much. Thanks for making the call. Joe in Vail, Colorado. You wanted to talk about...
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure. Got a minute to the break.
You know, I was listening earlier, and I listened to your comment about George Bush and Dick Cheney being little boys and not getting out of the car.
Well, I was wrong.
Well, I understand. I've listened to that and heard that you were wrong. But I was wondering, why would you make a comment like that anyhow, even if you were correct? I mean, what would...
Because the... Well, it was how I prefaced it. The main message of the Bush presidency was be afraid. It was... A nation that... I mean, Osama bin Laden was not a nation. He was a guy. He had, at the most, 25,000 people who had been through his training course and maybe 5,000 people who supported him. Afghanistan offered to turn him over, to arrest him and turn him over to a third nation for trial. And George Bush wanted to have a war. He had told Mickey Herskowitz 2 years before he was elected in 1998 that his father's biggest mistake was to end his war in only 3 days. That if he had extended that war until the next election, he would have been reelected. I mean, this was, you know, using fear and division as a political tool was the strategy and technique of the Bush-Cheney administration. And it still is. I mean, they still talk like this. This is what the neocons are all about. And I am very pleased that we have a president who increasingly is saying he's not even going to use the word war on terror, the phrase.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
He's doing what Teddy Roosevelt said, walk softly and carry a big stick. Obama's the one who got bin Laden. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and 34 minutes past the hour. Oh, this should be interesting. Byron in Amherst, New Hampshire, you want to disagree with me? Go for it.
Hi, Mr. Hartman. Thank you for taking my call. I just heard you mention that you believe that former President Bush and former Vice President Cheney, you called them, I can't remember the exact term, but you criticized them.
Fearful little men.
Yes. You said that they used fear in order to, I assume you're essentially talking about the Patriot Act, which curbed certain civil rights, basically because we were fearful of terrorism.
No, actually, right? I wasn't thinking of the Patriot Act. What I was thinking of was Tom Ridge going when he was head of the Department of Homeland Security after he left, going on David Letterman's show and talking about the election of 2004 and talking about how they kept flipping the terror alert from orange to red every time John Kerry got some good press, and he could never figure out why. He couldn't figure out the reason, but he was told to do it by Karl Rove in the White House. I was thinking about the constant reference to 9/11 by these guys.
About that.
I was thinking about how these guys had deified essentially 9/11, which was their own intelligence failure. You know, that's what I was thinking about.
I wouldn't call it completely their intelligence failure. There was certainly some issues from the
CIA sent a guy in May of 2001 down to the ranch. George Bush had already taken the longest vacation of any president in the history of the United States. CIA sent a guy to personally warn him that bin Laden was coming to attack the United States. And this isn't no conspiracy theory. This you can easily find, you know, it's reported in all the major newspapers. Bush patted him on the back and said, okay, you've covered your ass, was the phrase he used, and you can go back to Washington, D.C. And then, you know, Bush sat down and read that. Condi Rice came down with this guy, debriefed him, you know, the memo, the famous memo, bin Laden determined to strike inside the United States. And then Bush decided to extend his vacation by another month. And then when his vacation was completely out, he still wouldn't go back to Washington, D.C. He was still afraid to go back to D.C. So instead, he went to Florida, where his brother locked down the entire state. And that's where he happened to be hiding when 9/11 happened. And I personally believe it's because he knew something bad was going to happen. I don't think he knew what it was. I'm not one of those guys who thinks it was some kind of false flag operation. In fact, I think he was horrified by it. I think he thought it was going to be something like the USS Cole, something relatively small. But whatever it was, he didn't want to be in D.C. when it happened, and he wasn't.
That's fine. I'm not going to debate that point with you because it's to be honest with you, it's far from the issue I wanted to talk about. My main point was that I see a lot of people on the left criticizing how Bush used 9/11, and I would agree with them. He did use it to perpetuate that culture of fear, to push through a lot of things that I think were unconstitutional, to put it mildly. However, I also see a lot of the same tactics used by President Obama to push through gun control things that I see as completely unconstitutional. And what bothers me the most about it is that there's no even debate about it. It's not even brought up in an intellectual way. It's brought up, like, for example, the speech he gave a few weeks ago, or maybe it was a week ago, where he put four children in front of him. And just, I mean, that in and of itself, I thought was completely exploitative.
Yeah, it's like Bush landing on the aircraft carrier.
Completely played on people's fears. instead of actually looking at the data and whether or not these gun control measures would work, he, you know, stifled debate completely by saying, look at the children, we have to do this for the children. And I was just wondering how you felt about that.
Well, I have looked at the data, and the countries that do have gun control don't have as many gun homicides and have much fewer gun suicides than we do here in the United States. So,
and again,
I mean,
if you looked at D.C. after the handgun ban, gun crime went up exponentially.
Well, you know, anytime you look at an individual city that has another city or states around it, I mean, I used to live in Portland. We were just, you know, on the other side of the river was Washington State. We banned fireworks. Washington State didn't. Everybody in Portland had fireworks on the 4th of July. You know, city by city, state by state bans generally don't work.
And
I agree with
you. That's a fair point. But so you would advocate having sweeping national gun control changes.
I'll share with you my two thoughts on this, and maybe you'll agree with me and maybe you'll disagree with me. The first is that the reason why, you know, we had cars starting around 1900. In fact, the first electric car was made in 1898. But it wasn't until the 1920s that we started having stop signs. And it wasn't until 1935 that we actually had national standards for stop signs and stop lights. And the reason why was because people were dying. When we figured out that cars were capable of killing people, they got good enough that they could go fast enough that when people got in a collision, they died. Then we said, okay, we've got to do three things. We've got to register the car so that, you know, we know whose it is and who's responsible for it. We've got to make sure that the driver knows how to drive, has some competency, has a driver's license. And the car and the driver have to have liability insurance. The very cheapest kind of insurance there is, liability insurance. Just a minimum insurance at the very least. And we've done that for five generations, and it's worked just fine. And we did that because cars could kill people. I think we should do the same thing with guns. That's my first.
Unfortunately,
there's
no constitutional right to drive a car. There is a constitutional right to bear arms.
Well, you know, we can debate that. I would say if you're a member of a well-regulated militia, then yeah, you have a constitutional right to a weapon. I know how to read. I've read the Second Amendment. I'm guessing you have too.
I understand it, and I appreciate you being.
And in fact, you know, Justice Scalia in the Heller decision said that the individual right to bear arms is a modifiable right. I forget the exact word that he used, but it's not unlike the First Amendment right to free speech. You have a right to free speech, but if you run into a crowded theater and start yelling fire, you go to jail. And so I'm saying this is the first half of how I would limit it. And I would say, by the way, we do have a constitutional right to drive cars. Roads are in Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution, you know, the authority to establish roads. But beyond that, then I would say also, weapons of war should be left to war. As a sports shooter, I would like to have access to weapons of war for fun. I've been on shooting ranges. I've fired AK-47s, I've fired Uzis, I've fired AR-15s, AR-14s, but I didn't own them. I rented them. You know, you go in and rent it for an hour, pay for the ammunition. I got no problem with that if it's in a controlled environment like that. But weapons of war should either be on a shooting range or they should be in a battle zone. On the other hand, hunters and people who want, you know, a pistol for self-defense or even a rifle for self-defense, they should be able to have those. But those are different kinds of weapons, and you know that. You don't need a 30-round clip to protect yourself.
But again, you know, look, we're not going to agree on this, to be quite honest with you. And all I wanted to, you know, is have an honest debate, which I think we did. And I just wish that the president felt the same way and actually would have an honest debate about this instead of, you know, and granted, both parties do this on a multitude of issues.
Sure.
They stifle debate with.
Well, they play their best card. They play their best card, Byron. I mean, you know, Bush's best card was.
Thank you very much for your time.
Okay. Thank you very much I appreciate it. Thank you. I don't disagree with you on that. And I think that that's an okay thing. But I just didn't like the card that Bush was playing. Kathy in Etna, Wyoming. Hey, Kathy. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. I've been reading your book, Screwed, and you reiterate we the people. In this book, and I just found today President Obama's words profound in that he repeated the words we, and it gives me hope that hopefully we are what it's about, what his job is about and what Congress's job is about, and it's time for them to work for us.
And I just, that does give me hope. Yeah. And I just wanted to share that with you, and thank you for your book.
Well, thank you, and thank you for reading it. Kathy, I appreciate the call, and I have a lot of hope right now. And I think the main thing is what President Obama said over and over and over again is you and me, as citizens, can do. In other words, our job as citizens is to be politically active. Tag, you're it. That's basically what the president said. Trent in Atlanta. Hey, Trent.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm a first-time caller, a long-time listener. I just wanted to make a comment real quick. It seemed where I work, we have the righties that bogart the break room in the TV, and it's Fox News, Fox News, Fox News every day, every day. You know, they're the loudest in the room. They're always complaining, yada, yada, yada. Well, today was a little bit different. Today, those people were pretty much marginalized by the diversity of where I work and the fact they changed it to ABC News, and there was people of all races, black, white. There were gay people there. There were Indians, immigrants there that I know that I work with. And basically, I thought of it as a microcosm of what's going on right now. So you've got the right that's blustering and yelling and the Tea Party, you know, yada yada yada. But I feel like if we come together, especially on the left, and organize that. You know, we can silence that super crazy right.
Well, I'm not interested in silencing anybody. I'd like to hear their voices. But on the other hand, I do think it's good for us all to, you know, hear people with eyes wide open. You know, like the earlier caller who was talking about how you know, both sides use their particular issues to promote things. But are you saying, Trent, that the people in your lunchroom in your place of work stood up and said, turn off Fox News, put on something else?
Yeah, basically what happened was I was sitting there, I usually eat there for lunch, and the president spoke at noon, and then as more people were coming in, somebody just blatantly changed the channel to ABC, and we watched the inaugural speech. It was great.
Very interesting. Okay, thanks for the call, Trent. Yeah, maybe that'll start happening in truck stops around America. That's the, you know, I a lot of truckers listening right now. We're on Sirius XM. And one of the things I've noticed in a lot of the truck stops that I've stopped at is it's always Fox News on the TV. Time to change the channel.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Or start talking back really loud to that TV set. On the other hand, I was agreeing with Charles Krauthammer earlier that the end of, you know, this is the end of Reaganomics. Welcome back. Is that a picture you took, Jim? Joe Biden with Clarence Thomas right behind him. And Sonia Sotomayor standing right next to him. And Justice Kennedy? Oh, yeah, that was Justice Kennedy with the cap, yeah, or the hat, yeah. Remarkable. Oh, my. John in Bloomsburg, Pennsylvania. Hey, John, thanks for listening to Sirius Satellite Radio. You have no hope with anyone in office, really?
No, and I really don't, Tom. And let me tell you why. First of all, I'm 54 years old. And I remember the first campaign I could get involved with, Jimmy Carter. Then it was John Anderson when I was in college, you know, the big third-party candidate.
Sure. But
the thing I've come to realize, it doesn't matter who's in power. No one is looking after the people who get up in there, go to work every day. And let me give you an example. I have a brother who makes $15 an hour. He gets up, goes to work every day. For the government, anyone to say, you have to wait until you're 67. To get a full Social Security, and that's all you're going to have. And his body's not going to hold out that long.
Yeah.
But yet, when we look at the spending, everything with the government, whether it's Democrats or Republicans, well, we can't afford to cut spending in social programs. But the thing is, they've got to get their pensions in line, their health care in line, because I'm not exaggerating. There are people, not so much the local level, but the state and federal level, that are retiring 10, 12 years before the average person on pensions that are way more than Social Security. And let me give you an example. Any standing.
But they paid into those pensions.
Pardon?
There's not a single union worker who is retiring with a pension who hasn't paid into that pension, either directly or by negotiating the pension in lieu of salary.
Okay, but.
So why are they not entitled to it?
Okay, this is where we lose the dialogue. I'm a person that says, look, I get up every day and go to work. Do you think a person should retire at age 55 with three quarters of their salary, and then they tell the average working man, you have to wait till you're 67 to get $1,500 a month?
Do you think that somebody who runs a health insurance company should be able to make over $1 billion?
You know what? I don't think.
Just as an employee?
I don't feel comfortable about that.
Okay, great. Then let me flip that back around. I'm guessing that you wouldn't feel comfortable about that because that's not an indication of being smart. That's really, you know, beyond somebody just being really smart. That's like somehow gaming the system. My response to your question about, you know, somebody retiring at 55 with a pension, three-quarters pension, is that person was smart enough or lucky enough. And maybe Stephen J. Hemsley at United Healthcare was just lucky, but smart enough or lucky enough to have had a good union. And what I would say is rather than criticizing the guy who retires at 55 with a three-quarters pension, why not fight for everybody to be able to do that?
Okay.
It would reduce unemployment dramatically. It would bring back the American middle class.
Is it fair that my county taxes should go up 24% in 1 year to subsidize that? I'm a middle class person. I make good money. I know I'm blessed. I'm glad I walk in the shoes I walk in. I'm going to be better off than most people. But what's happening is we are not going to get where we need to be in this.
Well, here's the choice. There's, you know, if you're complaining about public employees being able to have decent pensions and retire, John, hear me out here, would you? Just let me just lay this out as a choice. Then you can rant on it. Basically, there are two choices. If you're concerned about, you know, public employees, government employees having decent pensions because they've got a good, strong union, either you can bring everybody down to the lowest common denominator. You can say to those government employees, you know, basically screw you. You're going to lose half your pension, just like all the people who worked for General Motors when they went through bankruptcy and lost their pensions. Or, you know, fill in the blank, Acme Company. Or you can say, let's work to bring everybody up to that so that everybody can have a decent job and a decent retirement. And that's what we did up until the Reagan presidency. Read the 1956 Republican Party platform for Eisenhower's reelection. They brag about the fact that an additional 1.7 million people joined unions and got pensions and full health benefits under the Republican administration, that over 3 million new people were eligible for Social Security under the Republican administration of Dwight Eisenhower. It used to be Republicans bragged about the fact that they helped bring all the working people up. Now they're complaining about the few people who are still up there trying to drag them down. That doesn't make sense to me, John.
No, you're missing the point here on one thing. Our economy now, it is a world economy.
Yes.
In the private sector.
No,
we
it's
are
not. Only for us. Germany protects their economy. Japan protects their economy. China protects their economy. They all use VAT taxes and tariffs. We don't. We're the suckers.
And here's why we will never be able to solve the problems in this country. And I'm going to give you an example. And let's just say Barack Obama was a Republican. I have a problem when I know a standing president is going to leave and make millions and millions of dollars a year in speaking fees, books, and everything, but yet the taxpayer has to pay for them to have security.
Yeah, you know how much money Jimmy Carter's made since he left the White House?
Jimmy Carter's a little...
Jimmy Carter was an honorable man, and is an honorable man.
You can't equate Jimmy Carter with Clinton or Bush or the others.
Or Reagan or Bush, yeah. No, I agree. That's my point. I think that we need more honorable men in politics, John. And John, but your point, you know, I'm guessing that somewhere between our two positions, we might find some points of congruence, but we'll have to live to debate that another day because we're out of time. Thank you for the call. Coming up tomorrow on the Tom Hartman Program, New York is fighting back against dark money in politics. We'll tell you how. I'll have a conversation with New York State Attorney General Eric Schneiderman, plus jobs, trades, then the debt ceiling. Oh, my! We'll talk with Senator Sherrod Brown of Ohio on the work ahead for a new Congress. and the best of the rest of the news and your calls right here on the Tom Hartman Program, occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week for we the people. And don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. It begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.